Okay.
Just doing it.
All right. Hi. Okay. Last day of February. 3 weeks till spring. 3 weeks from today or tomorrow. Wednesday. Okay. You want more light? I can see that. Okay, that's better. You want less light here. Okay, there. Okay, third exercises and other leftover papers are up here. Be sure to get yours if you haven't. And those are tentative because I haven't gotten confirmation back from the people, from the computer, from the combination of people and computer that schedule campus events. So I will send an email when those are confirmed. I will put them on the website. There will also be some other things on the website, probably tomorrow afternoon, maybe Wednesday morning. So I'll let you know. Stay tuned. We were talking about developmental trajectories. And that was one of the long definitions. And since you have it in the book, I'm not going to put it all up there right now. So, questions about that or anything else? What about when people are in a setting by him or herself, themselves, people as plural? Okay. How does that fit in with everything? How do you hope it fits in?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But Bronfenbrenner doesn't deal with it directly, right? That's why you asked the question, because he hadn't dealt with it in the book. Right. But it's a great question, and it's a very important question, and it goes back to the question, to repeat, is where does being in a setting by yourself fit in all of this, since so much of the emphasis, correct me if I elaborate in the wrong direction, but when somebody hands you the entree to something that you wanted to talk about, you run with it. I'm running with it. Since so much of what Bronfenbrenner talks about is what happens in relations within settings, and since the setting is defined as a place where people can engage in face-to-face interaction, does that rule out settings where people are not engaging in face-to-face interaction, where there is simply one person? It does not rule it out. So there is, if a place is a setting, it's probably important because there's the potential for face-to-face interaction or a relation to be going on in that setting. But some settings don't. Some of you couldn't get another person in your car along with all your personal belongings, books, notes, food, and empty bottles. But theoretically, a face-to-face interaction could happen there. The reason it becomes important and why it is included in Bronfenbrenner's scheme, although he doesn't address it directly, is that what he's really interested in is the proximal processes, the activities that you're engaged in. And he says early on that proximal processes often include interactions with other people, but are not restricted to interactions with other people or transactions with other people. So he suggests that reading a book, writing a poem, any activity that you're engaged in may be a proximal process if it's contributing to your development. It's an activity that you're engaged in. So he doesn't deal with it directly, but he deals with it indirectly by suggesting that the important activities may be ones that you engage in by yourself. And that fits with a great deal of the developmental literature, which suggests, for example, that solitude is crucial for adolescents to stay healthy. To have time to sit and think, to reflect, to engage in that proximal process of reflection and analysis and interpretation, figuring out how you feel, journal writing, all of those sorts of things, all of those are important in development. And what would be important to think about is an ecosystem that didn't permit those activities to go on. It would be a different kind of life that you would live if you were never alone. Should have brought the paper today. Did any of you read Dear Annie? The advice column today? The situation was a woman and her boyfriend. They both have been married before. They each have a child from previous marriage. They're not married, but they live together. They have been for 5 years. And his 15-year-old daughter comes every other weekend and for the entire summer. And while she is there, the complaint in the letter is, while she is there, she refuses to sleep alone. So she sleeps with them. And if she's trying to sleep alone, I don't have all the details in mind, she refuses to allow them to have their bedroom door closed. So you can imagine you might get away with that for a weekend and not have any privacy, but for the summer, this is grounds for slapping somebody upside the head and saying this has to change, which is exactly what the advice was. But you can imagine being in an ecosystem that didn't allow you time alone, or in their case, time together for certain important activities if you're going to maintain a relationship that is satisfying to two people in a live-in sort of relationship. I don't know how that was related, but it was something about being an ecosystem that didn't allow for particular kinds of activities that might be important. But here's a 15-year-old who's A, ruling the roost, and so her role is inappropriate, and she's keeping other people from engaging in activities that are important to them. And she is, by inference, never alone and doesn't want to be alone. And this is probably not good. Think about solitary confinement and its uses. Many people who write a lot or read a lot think, wouldn't it be really fun to have a 10-year prison sentence and be able to just read and write all the time, not have anything else to do? We don't follow that fantasy very far, but it suggests that solitude and the proximal processes or the molar activities of reading and writing and reflecting are important to us, important enough that we would at least momentarily engage in the fantasy that it would be fun to be forced to be in a situation where all the other activities and relations were precluded or restricted. The desert island kind of fantasy. The prison is better than desert islands because they give you 3 meals a day, and a roof over your head, and a shower, interlibrary loan, and all that kind of stuff. Okay? Is that it? Okay. Other questions? About mesosystems, developmental trajectories, exams? Eco exam. Finally.
I know that we're doing a review on Wednesday. Mm-hmm.
Would you like a review sheet like that? It's in the syllabus. So I don't know that I could do any better than that. I could change it from all caps to real letters, upper and lower case. But I think if you go through that piece by piece, item by item, everything is in there. If you discover something that isn't in there, let me know, because I'll add it. And what I've tried to do in this set of expectations is to tell you what you ought to be able to do with the material that you're learning now. Okay? So go through that. Think about how things change over time. Think about how they're related to each other. And the key is down here at the bottom when it says you should be able to use the whole system to interpret a brief news story, interpret articles about development, or interpret your own development. I won't ask you to interpret your own development on this exam. I will give you an article or a brief news story or both about development and ask you to identify the characteristics of the ecosystems that are described in that article. It won't be open-ended. It'll be, identify three settings that are mentioned in this article. Oh, is that me or is it outside? I'm still not adapted to the construction out there. Okay, so I won't ask you to do an open-ended interpretation. I'll ask you very specific questions. Identify two kinds of dyads that exist in this story or this article. What in the article refers to an exosystem setting? There'll be very specific things like that. But it will require you to read the story or the news article and make those connections. And we'll practice one of those on Wednesday. Remind me, please, to bring something. That's out there. It's not me. I don't have that kind of indigestion. Other formats. There'll be actually two or three or four different kinds of items. I will ask you to read the definitions, microsystem, mesosystem, ecosystem, whatever they are, and I'll give you the definitions and I'll ask you to match those with what they're defining so you can sort those out. You should be able to recognize the definition of a macrosystem or an exosystem or a setting and pick them out. That's basic stuff. In the past, I have asked a series of questions that ask you to identify, for example, four or five. Well, I'll give you a list of 8 or 10 characteristics of mesosystems potentially, and ask you which of those would be good for a person's development. And you just identify the ones that are that would facilitate development. I might do that for a setting. Here are 3 or 4 or 8 characteristics of a setting. Which ones would be good for a person's development? And those are straight out of either the propositions or the hypotheses. Okay. So it's really very basic stuff. It's quite objective. There's not very much for you to do, actually, in Zayden. They like them. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that for the macro system, which we'll talk about today and probably swap over into Wednesday a little bit. The macro system doesn't lend itself to that kind of item in the way that meso and exo and micro do. Okay? So if you've been keeping up and you understand the stuff basically, if you understand all the hypotheses, and if you have done any of the suggested exercises, if you've tried to play with this stuff beyond the exercises that were required, it shouldn't really be a problem. Enough? Okay. Other questions? And lo and behold, it probably won't even take you the whole period. Oh, the eco exam is a week from today, in here, at this time. Okay? Anything else? All right. John.
So, you know,
no, I wouldn't ask you to cite the hypothesis or to recite the hypothesis. I wouldn't ask anything like, thank you for asking that, because I know some people are going to panic about that about Sunday night when they think about it, or Monday morning. Do I have to know all the hypotheses by number? No, I won't ask you. What would hypothesis 37 suggest that about? I won't do that. If I want you to consider a particular hypothesis, I will give it to you. And I won't refer to them by number. I don't know them by number except three or four of them. Julie and Greg know all the ones they graded from the third exercise. They can recite those because they have memorized them. But I occasionally do. But I think the only one that I really know is 37 and 50. I think I know that one. So I won't ask you to do that. So it's not a big memorization. It's really an understanding test, how to apply this stuff. Okay? And again, it's low anxiety because even if you haven't done any reading and don't understand anything, you can come and take it and find out what it's like. And then when you have to retake it, which you will, if you don't understand it and haven't done the reading, most likely, unless you're a damn good guesser, when you retake it, you'll have a much better sense of what it's like. Okay? All right. We were talking about developmental trajectories, and I think I pretty much wrapped that one up. Let me just remind you about hypothesis 48. It says sometimes when you're learning something in a particular setting, you're developing motivation, you're developing a new understanding of the world, you're not really going to find out how well you have done that until you move to a new setting. And sometimes that may take some period of time before you actually get an opportunity to use what you've learned. So Bronfenbrenner is interested in what he calls sleeper effects. Something happens in a particular setting, you never really get a chance to use it particularly well or often, maybe not at all, but it's information or understanding that you construct in one setting and then at some later point you have the opportunity to use it. And that is consistent with the constructivist notion of developing understanding, because you often may not know how you're going to use or apply something that you've constructed in your understanding. You may not have a sense of what you will be able to connect it to until you get into a situation that encourages you to make that connection or to use that or apply that understanding. So it's consistent with the constructivist notion that we would understand things that we hadn't had the opportunity to apply yet. He's suggesting that when that happens, sometimes these are very significant steps in our development, and he calls those primary transitions, when we move from the situation of studying something but not being able to apply it to a situation where we're in fact going to apply it. One of the examples that sometimes comes up is the person who has gone through 4 years of college or five and gotten a degree in education and done student teaching and goes out into a school, and several months into the experience does something in a class in a situation that she's not done before, but realizes that she's applying something that she had the basis for in her student teaching or in a class when she was a junior year. And that's a very optimistic and kind of hopeful thing. It lets us say to you, even if something doesn't seem like it might be important, you may be developing an understanding, a skill, a potential that you will apply later. And that will be a sleeper effect. Another example of a sleeper effect with a primary transition, we've already talked about a little bit, but that is our tendency to apply what we learned at home as children to our lives when we create a family as adults. So we may not really understand what we are learning about how to be a parent while we are being parented. But we are coming to understand the world and the role of parent from watching our parents as they parent us. We're learning to be childed or to be to child. Can I use that way? Anyway, from our parents who are parenting us, and they're putting us in the role of child, we're absorbing the role of parent. We're coming to understand that. And then many years later, we find ourselves parenting a child. We're on the other side of that role, and as often happens, we are discovering that we do it really well, or that we are really frustrated by it, or we hear ourselves saying things we thought would never come out of our mouths because we hated them when they came out of our parents' mouths. Those are sleeper effects. And if you're among the lucky developing, you had great parents, and you never really think about how you're going to parent, but you find yourself in a situation with a child knowing exactly what to do because that's what your parent did. And you haven't rehearsed it, you haven't done it, there it is. It's part of your construction of how to do this job as parenting, even though you've never had a parenting course. You had a long, long parenting course from your parents. That's an example of a sleeper effect. And I think I ended with the direction and degree of psychological growth are guided or governed by the degree to which particular settings are open or closed to you. So, if you're going to develop some skills or some understanding, it's necessary that you be in settings where it's possible to do that. And other settings might have contributed, but if you can't get into them because of your race or your social class or where you live, then you're not likely to be able to follow a particular developmental trajectory. Now, 50, which I said I might know, I actually don't. I can't recite this one. I know what it's about. because I've had to explain it so often. What hypothesis 50 suggests is that as you're going from one primary setting, and by primary just simply means an important one, where you have primary dyadic relationships and engage in important molar activities, what is important is the match between what is going on in the first or previous primary settings and what is expected and possible in the second developmental setting. So when you think about a developmental trajectory as a series of settings that promote the development of a particular kind of skill or molar activity, a set of attitudes and motivation, the ability of those settings in sequence to keep that developmental trajectory going depends on their fit with the previous settings. They don't have to be the same, but they should allow you to exercise the skills, the understanding that you were developing in the previous setting. So they should be consistent with it and allow for it to become more complex. Allow for you to have perhaps more power. Allow for you to engage in the activity in a more complex way. If they don't do that, then they're not contributing as effectively to the developmental trajectory. So sometimes you go into settings that don't allow you to do what you're used to doing, that set you back, don't give you as much opportunity. And that represents a poor match between what's gone on in the previous settings and what you can do in the new one. Any of you had the experience of being frustrated going into a setting where you weren't allowed to do the sorts of things that you were capable of doing and you knew that? Oh yeah, that one. The example is going back home after you've lived away for a while. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, that example is going back to a setting that you've been in before. I think that's a little bit different. Both of those are a little bit different than what Bronfenbrenner is suggesting. How about one where you go into a new setting that doesn't allow you to engage in, a new setting that doesn't allow you to engage in activities that you're capable of being in? Mm-hmm. Were they also, the example is a restaurant, you shifted from one restaurant to another and they wouldn't let you start at the level of skill or just the level of pay?
The level of skill.
The level of skill. So they didn't trust you to be able to do that. Yeah, I have an example that my nephew is a waiter, professional waiter. Also a stand-up comic, but he doesn't make any money at that, but he gets lots of tips. He works in one of those New York restaurants that I can't afford to go in. Yeah. I could go look at the menu and order the appetizer and they wouldn't give me a table, or they'd make me give it up. But he wears a tuxedo and he makes the big bucks waiter-wise. But in the past, he's done that shift several times, and one of them, when he first got to New York, he was working in a restaurant that was a pretty good one, and but it changed owners and he didn't like them, so he left and he went to another one, told them about the experience he'd had, and they let him start as a busboy. And he'd been a head waiter. They made him start as a busboy. It was really, really frustrating. And he went up pretty quickly, but it wasn't what he was looking for. The one he's in now allows him. He's literally a stand-up comic and waiter, and it's okay. The manager knows that. Floor manager knows that when Lee's customers are laughing, they're going to stick around. They're going to order another bottle of wine, and Lee's going to get big tips from it. Even if they only tip 10%, he's going to get big tips in that restaurant. Okay. Let's move suddenly to the exosystem. And the exosystem refers to those settings that may have intermediate links to your mesosystem, but the exosystem is specifically the relations that happen between settings that you don't participate in. That's why exo, meaning outside, is the prefix for this part of the system. And what Bronfenbrenner is trying to do is help us understand that there are settings that we don't participate in, particularly when we're children, but in general, there are settings that we don't participate in that have an impact on our development because they influence it. Things go on in those settings that influence it. It may be a setting that our parents work in. It may be a setting that they are concerned about. It may be any number of settings. I won't go through all the possibilities because you can generate those. But the defining characteristic of exosystem settings is that what goes on in them does not include the developing person. So you have your mesosystem, which is the relations among all those settings that you do participate in, and then you have other settings that are important in your life, but you don't go in, and the exosystem refers to those settings and their relationships with the settings that you do participate in. And so, to draw that, we can take settings A and B, which you are part of. So the person is in there, and what happens between them, each of these, A and B, has a microsystem in it. Okay? Remember that. What goes on between them, the way they're related, is the mesosystem. And then there may be another setting, C, that doesn't have the developing person in it, so it's not part of that person's mesosystem, but it may influence what happens in one or both of the other settings. So that influence defines the exosystem, the setting that the person is not in, and its relationships to mesosystem settings are the exosystem. Exosystem settings also have a microsystem in them. Each of them has a microsystem. Something is going on there. And if it has influence on the developing person, it does that by impacting what goes on in mesosystem settings. So there may be an intermediate link, which is part of the exosystem in this case. So maybe Dad is in the mesosystem setting with the developing person, and Dad is in the exosystem setting, and what goes on with Dad in that setting, in the exosystem setting, comes home in some way. It's a pretty straightforward notion, and you can probably come up with lots of examples, so I'm not going to dwell on it and beat it to death today. But if you have questions about whether something is an exosystem setting or how it might be related, I'll take those. The question is whether there has to be an intermediate link, and the answer is no. There doesn't have to be a person directly involved in your mesosystem system who is also directly involved in an exosystem setting. So that's an optional way that exosystem settings are connected. And probably the most directly influential ones do have, particularly as we're looking at families, because if parents are working, or if a sibling in the family spends a lot of time in the hospital, but the person that we're looking at doesn't go to the hospital with the sibling, then the hospital becomes an exosystem setting because of the sibling's involvement and the parents' involvement there and all the stress that goes on when kids are in hospitals. So the ones that have the intermediate links are likely to be the ones that are most important directly to a child. But what you raise is the question of where things happen that might influence, for example, one that came up last week. Medicaid funding has been reduced. Fill in your own political response to that. And many states are finding it necessary to reduce who is covered by Medicaid and what services they will pay for. And in one state I was talking to, okay, we can make it a Larry story, it's my daughter, in New Mexico, Medicaid, with its reduced funding and increased demand, no longer will provide food for families of children who are hospitalized when those children are eligible for Medicaid. And the family, in my daughter's case, the family is flown in from another part of the state or another state to the hospital, and they often stay there for 10 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And you want families to be involved if you're dealing with infants and young children, so you encourage that. Medicaid used to feed them. They used to provide as part of the insurance package for the kid, they would feed one of the parents. And the parents who are eligible for Medicaid often are losing income while they're at the hospital because they're hourly workers without sick leave. They don't have plastic, they don't have lines of credit, they don't have savings accounts. They just have sick kids. And my daughter's experience with that is that the families are looking for trays that kids haven't finished the food on so they can ask if they can finish it. They're bringing in peanut butter and crackers. There are often other siblings involved in the hospital with them. They don't have any place to put them up and they don't have any food for them. So staff, nurses and doctors are bringing in healthy snacks for the parents because Medicaid, which used to just say, okay, send them to the cafeteria, and you know, and charge it to the bill, parent meal, and Medicaid would pay for it. So they're not doing that. Okay. So that's an exosystem setting someplace decided that that in order to provide the medical care for the kids, they wouldn't feed the parents, and it's affecting what goes on in the hospital in many ways for the kid and for the families. So it's affecting the family's ability to function as a unit. Okay. So nobody in the families was involved in that decision. Nobody was involved in where those Medicaid decisions are made. Those are in their exosystem. They were made. Some human being made those changes in response to whatever budget constraints they had, and they are affecting kids' development. I'll tell you the rest of the story later. What that raises is, for Bronfenbrenner, the issue of where are decisions made that affect your life? And how much do they take into account your needs as a person? They are definitely part of your ecosystem, because they're going to influence what you can do, what activities are available, what settings are open or closed to you, what activities you have to engage in, what kinds of relationships you can have. Bronfenbrenner calls places where important decisions about your life are made power settings. Settings where people have and exercise power. Where decisions are made that will influence how much money goes in your pocket, how much food goes in your mouth, how much rent you have to pay, how much tuition you have to pay, and any place where decisions are made that affect your development is a power setting. And it's likely to be in your exosystem unless you are directly involved. And if you're a child, it's highly unlikely that you'll be directly involved. Children are affected constantly by what happens in other settings. So power settings are where the decisions get made. They're in your exosystem. And for Bronfenbrenner, the political proposition is that the farther removed you are from where the power is being exercised, the less likely that power is to be exercised in ways that will favor your development. And so he provides us the specific suggestion that the developmental potential of a setting in your mesosystem depends in part on how many steps you have to take to get to where the power is. So if a setting in your mesosystem is going to be important and facilitate your development, but it is influenced by power settings in important ways, such as whether or not you get fed or whether or not you have health care, it's likely, he's suggesting, that the farther away, the more steps you have to take through other settings, through other people, to get to the power, the less likely it is that that setting that you're actually in will be able to operate on your behalf. Now, there's a problem with his wording, and I'll change this. In the book, I've tried to explain it, but I realized that I can actually change his wording. And one of my tasks for tomorrow is to write Uri and ask him if he would mind if I change the notion of intermediate link here. Remember that one, intermediate link, how mesosystem settings, how settings are connected? The intermediate link has a different meaning here. So what I would like to do is have you just go into your book and change intermediate here to intervening, because that's what he means. I'll ask him if he has a different word he would like. But what he means is that there's a chain of links, steps I call them, that connect settings to the power settings. And what he's suggesting is the longer that chain is, the less likely it is that that power setting is going to understand you, understand your needs, or make decisions that have any influence or positive influence on your life. Okay. So what Bronfenbrenner suggests, and the section on advocacy in the book elaborates on this, is that if you are a developing person or you're helping developing people, you have to get to where the power is. You have to get to those settings. You have to actually participate in them. If you want the school board to make a decision that's favorable to you, go talk to the school board. Or if you're a kid and little kid and can't do that, then you get somebody else to go. And that's why people need advocates. They need somebody from their Mesosystem to go to those power settings and help the people make decisions, help educate them, help them understand the impact of their decisions. So what Bronfenbrenner says, and you have to listen to this one really closely or you get into trouble. He says that the goal is to turn those exosystem settings into mesosystem settings. And you do that by going to them, by participating in them. So you go to legislative committee hearings. You go to places where regulations are being promulgated. You participate in those settings to the degree that you can. So what he says is, where exo is, there shall meso be. Meso be. Right. Did I lose me? You have to listen. It's meso be, not eso be. So you want to change the exosystem setting into a mesosystem setting, and then it will have more influence on you that's positive, ideally, theoretically. Now, I skipped over the hypothesis that comes before that, which is that what you need to have is as many connections to that exosystem setting as possible that are going to operate in your behavior, in your behalf. So things that are going to go on in that exosystem setting are going to be done with knowledge about who you are. The rest of the story. My daughter, annoyed by the lack of food for families, since she's trying to direct a unit that does family-oriented medicine and involves the families and other practitioners in the pediatric unit. So she looked around and said, what would it take to feed these people? And that's something you can figure out. About $120,000 a year, which the hospital doesn't have. And they used to get it from Medicare and Medicaid, and now they don't have it. So, did she whine? Yes. But not until she had figured out that she needed to whine in the right places. Knowing her ecosystem, you got to find out, A, where the money is, B, who controls the money, and how you get there. And the hospital, like the university here, won't let you contact people with money directly. You have to go through the development office. So she's working with the development officer in the hospital, the one who's responsible for finding sources of money. And they are putting together a direct and pointed request to the provider of food service to the hospital suggests a very large annual charitable donation to feed the parents. And they're calculating what that $120,000 would do to Sodexo Marriott, which runs the food service for not only the hospital, but the entire University of New Mexico campus. And they've calculated that $120,000 would be just a little drop in the bucket for what Sodexo Marriott gives, generally, from its, fill in your own adjective, profits, what kind of profits those are that you make for them because you have your food plan and I eat there. They make a profit from, and they, as a good corporation or a corporation that doesn't want to get into deep doo-doo, gives money to worthy causes. What could be worthier than feeding hungry parents of hospitalized kids? So she's activated her mesosystem, her understanding of her ecosystem. She's gone to the development officer. They will go together to Marriott and figure out if they can get some money for the parents. So that was the rest of the story. Okay. Other questions about the exosystem? Yes. That's a yawn and stretch. Okay. No, is this a question? No, it's not a question. Okay. Okay. Let's look at a couple of definitions for a moment. These aren't in the book. If you have an ecosystem, as we now do, we've looked at settings, microsystems, relations, roles, activities within those settings, within the microsystems. We've looked at the way settings are connected. We've looked at today exosystem settings. You don't need to copy these down. You can just find them. And I would never ask you to define society. I just threw it up there so that we could start at that some point about talking about culture and society. It's necessary, if you're going to talk about an ecosystem, to place it in culture. Unless you want to consider the whole world or universe as your ecosystem, and that gets a little unwieldy. But Bronfenbrenner is very aware that the kind of culture or subculture or society that we grow up in is important in determining how we develop and what we encounter. What kinds of beliefs and standards of behavior and what the expectations are, what kinds of roles there are, those are all embedded in society or culture. So here are the definitions for those two, and think about them for a minute. A society is a group of human beings broadly distinguished from other groups by mutual interests, participation in characteristic relationships, shared institutions, and a common culture. Mutual interest suggests activities. The people in a society engage in similar or shared activities. Do they have similar motives? Motivation, probably. Do they participate in relationships that are similarly organized within the society? Probably. And a common culture. Well, what does culture mean then? Culture is the totality of socially transmitted behavior patterns, arts, beliefs, institutions, and all other products of human work and thought. And these products considered as the expression of a particular period, class, community, or population. So what Bronfenbrenner is about to address is how a society might differ from another society. How do you know you're in a different culture? How do you know when you have moved from one society to another or from one culture to another? That's a question. How do you know that? When you move from one culture to another, how do you know you've changed cultures? Okay, so you know you're in a society or a culture when you see people doing similar things. How do you know when you move from one culture to another? Take that next step. If you see people doing one sort of thing in one culture, how do you know when you step out of that culture into a different culture? You run into something different. And so people are doing something different. And so you have run into a new culture when you discover another group of people doing similar things, but they're different. that they're doing things that are similar within their group, but they're different from some other group. So culture might be something we're really not particularly aware of. We all grow up in a society, but we may not be particularly aware of it. It may not hit us between the eyes very often. But when we move into a different culture, that may hit us very... What's the word I want? Saliently. There may be a big impact of that. How many of you have been in a different culture? What was different about it?
Language
was different. So they say things differently. There's a whole set of skills. The vocabulary is different. What else was different coming from Japan to the United States?
Food.
Clothes.
Clothes. Learning style.
Learning style. Teaching style. Relationship between teacher and student?
No.
A little different? Another hand. I'm sorry. Greeting one another. Mm-hmm. Okay. So people have different ways of greeting. I read the paper, obviously, and I read the funnies. So today's Dilbert. Anybody read today's Dilbert? The pointy-haired guy is going to send, which one, not Dilbert, but the other one, off to Albonia, where they do some outsourcing of manufacturing, and he needs to study the culture a little bit. So he goes to his Albonian culture lesson, and the Albonian teacher is telling him that this gesture, whatever it is, it's not clear in the cartoon, but let's say it's this one, means either hello or I'd like to see your mittens on my bedroom floor, baby. One or the other. So there are different ways of greeting. You brought it up, I didn't. Albania is a different culture, so we need to study it. They need to study it before they go into it. Other experiences of moving from one culture to another. Have any of you gone to school in a different culture? What was it like? In Trinidad? More strict? Right, so the cane is still there. Trinidadian system is based on what other system? So I'm guessing it's a British system since England occupied Trinidad a long period of time. So I'm guessing that it's a British-based system, which is stricter, less student involvement even now in England, less student power. And you can be disciplined the same way you can at home, which in the English system at least used to mean corporal punishment, which is not permitted in the United States most of the time. Well, it is, but you have to document it. There's so much paperwork involved with documenting paddling a kid that nobody does it very often. Okay. Other school experiences, different cultures. England. Is it like Trinidad? Stricter?
Yeah, pretty much. Okay.
Spain.
There wasn't that one break, but there's cigarette breaks.
Cigarette breaks in Spain.
And then the teachers would go out and it was formal, but there's kind of a lack of discipline, like a lot of chatting going on.
Mm-hmm. And what grades? High school. Okay, so cigarette breaks, which American kids also have had in high school until recently. Any of you go to high school with cigarette breaks for students? Smoking tip? No. The culture has changed. We had a smoking area when I was in high school. Teachers smoked, kids smoked, everybody smoked. That's why we're all dying of lung cancer. But the Spanish system is set up differently. How else would you know if you had stepped into a different culture? Any of you been in a really, really different culture where the houses look different? How many of you live now in a house with a thatched roof? Did you in England? England, they're still thatched roof. They still know how to do it. Ireland and the islands, the Hebrides, they still thatched roofs. It's very effective, by the way. No, none of you, and you've never been any place where there were thatched roofs? Okay. Yeah. Okay, so in traditional housing in the Philippines, before people became highly westernized, the houses are made up of bamboo and cane, and they're very, very different. And some portions of the Philippines continue, some portions of the society continue in housing in that mode. And so some cultures might focus on a different area of knowledge, such as, I'm going to edit that, navigation by the stars. If you're growing up in Polynesia, one of the things that you need to do is to get from island to island, and they still teach young people to navigate by the stars, which takes a great deal of time, but they develop very, very good spatial relationships, and it's not just the stars, because they also navigate by wind direction and the condition of the sea, and they can literally go from island to island when they can't see the island and don't have compasses, which is quite a skill. How many of you can do that? Some of you can't even get across Lake Champlain on your own. And I have had the wonderful experience of trying to do it in the fog in a sailboat without a compass, which was lots of fun. Didn't run into anything, but it was fun. Okay, so how many of you have lived in a country where men are permitted to have more than one wife at the same time? Let's talk about families for a minute. How are they different in different cultures? Ninety-five percent of the women have affairs while they're married.
Right, and men as well.
And men. So fidelity within monogamy is not an expectation. Monogamy, yes, but fidelity, no. Because 95% of people have sexual relationships with others. Where is this? Small where?
Costa Rica.
Okay. Huh. How many of you knew that about Costa Rica? I was just questioning. My best friend spends a week or two in Costa Rica teaching UVM course in Costa Rica, and my son's father-in-law is living there now, and my stepdaughter is going to Costa Rica for spring break. Now I know why they're going and where they're going, right? No, I don't. Hope not. Okay, so family forms may be different. How many of you have lived in a culture in which eldest daughters are required to stay at home and take care of their parents and not marry? Or to come home and take care of their parents until their parents die, leaving their spouses if they have married? Well, rural Ireland. How many of you live in a culture where all young people live with their parents until they marry? Philippines? India. It's expected in many parts of India that you live at home. You're not expected to leave home, and in fact, you're strongly discouraged from leaving home until you are married. How many of you have lived in a culture where you have to have your parent, your husband's permission, if you're female, to talk to another male? No. Okay. So you haven't done it. All right. So there are lots of cultures you haven't been in. How many of you believe there is one like that? How many of you believe there are half a dozen like that? Okay. You're prepared to think about the macro system then. How do we know when we're in a different culture? For Bronfenbrenner, since he wants to make the notion of culture fit into his entire ecosystem notion, one of the ways that you do that is to think about what culture is. And in his case, it's consistent and compatible to define culture as the macro system, the largest system that you participate in. And he defines that as the consistencies in the microsystem and the mesosystem and the exosystem settings and the systems that exist within a particular culture or subculture. So think about the settings that exist, and let's call them home. Let's look at home around the world. Within a particular culture, home is likely to have a certain set of physical features. And in a particular subculture, that might include a bedroom for every person, except the parental couple who have their own. In another cultural, the subcultural system, it might include everyone sleeps in the same room. In one culture, it might mean that every home has a kitchen. In another culture, it might mean that no home has a kitchen because you live in a cluster of families with one kitchen and all the meals are prepared communally. So you feed the whole community, small community, from one kitchen which belongs to the community, and nobody has to have and nobody has a kitchen. Their home wouldn't be designed with a kitchen. Think about school as a kind of setting. If you're in the United States and you go into a school for children 5 to 12, you're most likely to find great consistency across the various schools. The thousands of schools in the United States for elementary school have self-contained classrooms with one teacher responsible for a group of children, maybe 12, maybe 25, maybe 35 children, all or almost all the same age, and with a microsystem that is quite similar across those thousands and thousands of settings. You have a teacher who reports to a principal, the teacher is in charge of the curriculum, the teacher is using textbooks which come from major publishing houses and are approved by Ohio, Texas, and California state boards of education. Even if you're in Indiana, they're approved in Ohio, Texas, or California, because if they're not approved by those states, the publisher is not going to publish them because it's not worth it. Okay. So some states you have to have your textbook approved, and if it's a health textbook and talks about contraception, it's not going to get approved in Texas, which is why none of your health books, the standard textbooks for health, talked about that. If you had one that did, it wasn't published by a major publisher. So there are consistencies across all those elementary schools, And in other cultures, the educational settings may look quite different. There may be kids of all ages. There may be three or four or five different teachers across the span of a day. There's not a self-contained classroom. In the United States, in 99%+ of those elementary school classrooms, there will be boys and girls together. There are very, very few sex-segregated classrooms in public schools in the United States. So those are consistencies. In other countries, there won't be any girls in school at all. They don't need it. So they'll be boys. And in that particular subculture or culture, education looks very different than it does here. So that's what he's referring to. The consistencies in the way typical settings are arranged, how they're designed, what kinds of microsystems there are in them. And what happens when you move to a different culture is that you run into the differences. Houses are different, families are different, roles are different, schools are different, on and on and on and on. So he comes down to his basic concepts of setting and microsystem roles, relations, activities as a way of anchoring the notion of culture and making it real. It's in what real people do and the way they live their lives that defines culture. Okay, review session, bring your questions on Wednesday.